I've noticed a number of peculiar incidents among the members of the student body, all having to do with rock and roll music.
Wham bam, Benjamin!
Now, if you don't think this song is the greatest song ever, I will fight you.
The Olivia Tremor Control, Neutral Milk Hotel, and the Apples in Stereo created some of the most beloved records of the 90s. Together, they make up the Elephant Six Recording Collective. I'm Greg Cotta of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis from WBEZ and Columbia College. This week, Greg and I revisit our conversation with Elephant Six producer Robert Schneider. And later in the show, we review the new album from the long-running 4AD band, Dead Can Dance.
You are listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time for some music news.
That's the track Want It Back by Amanda Palmer and the Grand Theft Orchestra. Greg, a couple of weeks back on the show, we talked about Amanda's incredible success raising money on the crowdfunding website Kickstarter. She was able to collect over $1 million so she could record a record completely independent of the major labels.
That's right, Jim. Kickstarter allows users to set up a page to raise money for any kind of creative project, and a lot of artists and musicians are turning to it to fund their work. To learn more about how the site is changing the way art is funded, we're joined by one of the co-founders of Kickstarter, Yancey Strickler. Yancey, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me.
So you launched in 2009, and it's grown exponentially since then. But when you started, there were a lot of other sites doing this, right? I mean, how did you want to differentiate yourself from the competition?
Well, there were three of us who started Kickstarter. It's myself, Perry Chen, and Charles Adler. And the idea for Kickstarter actually first came to Perry in 2000 and 2001 when he wanted to put on a show in New Orleans, actually have Kruder and Dorfmeister play during Jazz Fest. But he didn't have the money to do it, and out of that he came up with this idea of having people essentially pre-purchase something before it happens, but people only being charged if a certain threshold of cash was reached. Later on, we saw that there were sites like Celeband and others out there, but we didn't feel like any of them came close to the model that we were imagining or the way that we implemented it.
What about the idea of launching something like this earlier? It seems to me like Kickstarter is like a quintessential new type of music company that maybe wouldn't have worked so well if you had, say, launched this in 1995. But it seemed like there was an opportunity here that you guys sensed at the turn of the post-Napster decade, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, that was not strategic. I wish I could claim that it was. You know, we launched the site the day that it was ready. If we had our choice, we would have launched it in 2005 or 2006. But our technical ineptitude was a huge barrier. You know, we're fortunate now in that Kickstarter really runs off of social media as a backbone. You know, when everyone has a Twitter account, a Facebook account, and a way that they can broadcast to seemingly limitless numbers of people, it makes something like Kickstarter much more palatable. When I think back to those early days and what we were imagining, I can't remember how we thought people were going to tell people about their projects, probably like MySpace widgets or something like that. I'm not really sure. But fortunately, the web has evolved in such a way that's allowed Kickstarter to exist and really be a big expression of this idea because, you know, the idea itself is not that dissimilar from patronage. You know, it's not that far from how Bach was creating symphonies.
Now, you guys take a 5% cut on money raised for a successful project, right?
That's correct.
All right, so it's not all just altruism. You're a business. If I want to be the cynical internet hipster, what do I need Kickstarter for? What are you doing for me for that 5%?
I think what Kickstarter's done is, one, is it's created a whole vernacular around this. You know, this is certainly not the first time that people have raised money or raised money from friends and family or raised money from a wider community, but there's a language that I think Kickstarter has fostered that has become pretty pervasive. The way the rewards are structured, the way the site looks and feels, and also there's just an enormous audience that comes to Kickstarter every day. You know, over 2 million people have backed a project, and about 600,000 have backed more than one. So those are people who are sitting around looking for cool things to be a part of. And so really, when you're putting a project on Kickstarter, at this point, you're putting it on one of the biggest stages in the world.
So Yancey, everybody knows the story, or most people have heard the story about Amanda Palmer, who used the Kickstarter campaign to raise over $1 million for her own record, which is amazing. But she's Amanda Palmer, right? She's got a name, she's got a reputation, she's got a fan base. Well, what if you're that unknown guy or gal, and you've got a great idea, and you come to Kickstarter with saying, hey, you know, I could raise $1 million too. I mean, what's the reality here?
Well, let me just jump back first and say the amazing thing about Amanda Palmer, I agree, is not that she had success raising funds from her fans. I mean, she's done a lot of hard work over the years to earn that. But what's amazing is that she raised $1.4 million, and she is an artist who knows where every cent related to her record has gone and is going. That might be the first time in the history of the music industry where that has occurred.
That's true.
The average project size on Kickstarter is about $5,000 or $6,000, you know, and the average pledge amount, $70. So what you're seeing is the most common project is getting 85 people to back it and to make the thing come to life. Not every project needs the huge numbers that Amanda gets. Amanda is an outlier. You know, the person who comes on who is making their first record or, you know, has a few fans in the town where they live and not much beyond that, that's the most common use case for Kickstarter, and those people do really well.
I think the last piece for me, Yancey, on this is you've proven that this has some worth. But to me, the big question now is, can artists sustain a career with this as the business model, as the foundation for their careers? I mean, what's your sense of this? Can Amanda Palmer go back to the well again in a couple of years and raise another $1 million?
I think that someone like Amanda, I think it makes her incredibly accountable if and when she does come back in a couple of years to do her next record. I think the success or failure of that will come down to how well she executed this one. Did she fulfill her promises? Did she give people a great record that people love? Did she continue to be Amanda even after this windfall? And if those things are true, I would expect her to do even better the next time around. You know, we're almost 3.5 years in, and in the past 6 months, we've started to see a lot of the early people using Kickstarter coming back for the second time. And what we found looking at those at success rates for those things, those projects are succeeding between 70 and 80% of the time, maybe even a little higher. And so people who did well the first time and who were able to deliver, they're finding incredible success the second time.
Well, we've been talking to Yancey Strickler, one of the three founders of Kickstarter, I think the premier crowdsourcing site for music and art in the U.S. Yancey, thanks for being on Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I really enjoyed it.
A bit of the track Hideaway by the Olivia Tremor Control from their 1999 album Black Foliage. Now, a few weeks ago, I added Hideaway to Desert Island Jukebox in memory of the late Bill Doss. Doss was a co-founder of the Olivia Tremor Control, one of the three big bands in what's known as the Elephant Six Recording Collective. Those three bands, the Olivia Tremor Control, Neutral Milk Hotel, Apples in Stereo, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they transformed indie music in the 90s. Get these four friends from this tiny town in Ruston, Louisiana. They start thinking about making music as high schoolers using these cheap four-track recorders. And they didn't really have a lot of musical knowledge, but together I think they made some of the classic psychedelic pop records of all time. These records, the Olivia Tremor Control's Dusk at Cuba's Castle, Neutral Milk Hotel's In the Airplane Over the Sea, and the Apples in Stereo's Fun Trick Noisemaker, I mean, they really hold up.
Absolutely, Greg. And Doss's death was a real shock. I know that you saw him perform with the Olivia Tremor Control at the Pitchfork Music Festival just last month. His death got us thinking about an interview we did back in 2007 with his good friend and frequent collaborator, Robert Schneider, really the driving force, the center of the Elephant Six Recording Collective. He isn't only the guitarist, vocalist, and lead singer for the Apples in Stereo, he was also the guru behind the four-track for all of these Elephant Six bands. Now, Robert's got a lot of energy. He talks about a million miles a minute, and I think he got us on that same vibration, too. But he's the guy to go to when you're talking about Elephant Six and everything that it hoped to accomplish. We turn to him for the story about how these friends got together and started making music. Hey, Robert, welcome to Sound Opinions, man.
Hey, guys, how are you?
We're good. We're good. We've been wanting to do this show for some time, looking at what the Elephant Six bands were about, where they came from. It's the mid-90s, right? As far as I gather from my map questing of it, Ruston, Louisiana, if it isn't officially the middle of nowhere, it's pretty darn close, right? Like 5 or 6 yeah. hours outside of New Orleans?
Yeah, it's probably like one step over from the middle of nowhere. The middle of nowhere is a suburb of Ruston.
How is it that you guys all came, the key bands in Elephant Six, Apples and Stereo, Neutral Milk Hotel, and Olivia Tremor Control, what the hell were you all doing in Ruston, Louisiana?
There's a university in town. It's sort of a middle-sized university, and it's not a particularly college-y town. It's not like there's, like, say, you know, head shops and used bookstores on every corner. It's a pretty conservative small town, but there is a university, and the university had a really strong art department. Probably in Louisiana, it was the number one art department, so lots of,
you're you talking know, about Louisiana Tech University.
Yeah, Louisiana
right?
Tech yeah. University. And so a lot of kids from all over the state, the kind of the outsiders would end up there in the art department, or you know, maybe studying photography or related studies. Also, it had a really strong radio station. A KLPI was an incredible station in the day. For you know, from the time that I first started listening to music in, say, third grade or so, I would listen to it, and it was it pretty much for me and for all of my friends, and probably everybody else of our age group from Ruston. You know, it was a really big influence on our kind of mental growth as well as our musical growth. And you know, over time, most of my friends worked at the station. Jeff Mangum was a station manager, I think. You know, everybody worked there in some capacity. You know, we used to record there. They had a little studio, and it was just a really good station. And I would say that was probably the unifying kind of thing, that in the art department. Now, we were all little kids. We were little kids, then junior high school kids, then high school kids. We weren't in the university, but we were, you know, we were in the tractor beam of the radio station.
Now, the way I heard it, Robert, is that you guys, even before you were in college, you know, the college kids would go home for the summer, and you guys, as high schoolers, would take over the college radio station, and, you know, gee, what is this krautrock shelf? Let's play this stuff. Let's play I'm on Duel 2.
Yep. Right? That was exactly right.
Right? And yeah. Pink Floyd and Pet Sounds and these records. You had this great library to discover.
And also we had very knowledgeable, extremely cool, super artsy older kids to guide us, you know, like college kids and stuff. And also we had in the nearby town of Monroe and in Shreveport, both of which are like Monroe, Louisiana is like half an hour from Ruston, and Shreveport's about an hour. There was an independent record store in each town that we would have to drive to go buy records and stuff. And you know, it made listening to music and getting your hands on music seem extremely romantic when it's so difficult.
It's a fascinating story because you know I interviewed Jeff Mangum in the mid '90s, right around the time of his first album, and he was saying that he felt that all of you guys were very sheltered. And the quote he said was, there was no local club to play in or see bands. Music was this weird, otherworldly thing. It was almost magical. It was like this magnet that was drawing us. And in a way, I think it was a way of escaping what Jeff saw as a very sort of mundane existence in this small, nowhere town. So creating this record was like another world.
Yeah, it really was like another world. From our earliest, I mean, you know, say fifth grade or so is when we started getting interested in playing music. I think Jeff took up drums in sixth grade, and I took up guitar. It was pretty cool. So you know, we were like, hey, you're playing drums, I'm playing guitar. We would kind of talk about music and hang out a lot. And as we got into junior high, we started recording and writing songs and kind of trading tapes and stuff. I mean, to call them songs is to over glamorize them. They were sort of flatulations or something, you know, they were amusing, and they had some small degree of production quality that we would impress each other with, you know, like, whoa, you have drums and guitar.
Well, let's focus on this, Robert, because it starts to get complicated, although the story starts to get good. Your friend Jeff Mangum that you were talking about, he becomes the key man in a band called Neutral Milk Hotel.
He had that band from high school. His solo recordings were always called Neutral Milk Hotel ever since since we were kids.
Okay, that was his group. Apples in Stereo is the band that you wound up forming, right? And then two Bills, William Cullen Hart and Bill Doss, started this band called Olivia Tremor Control. Now, I think these are the key bands in what would become the Elephant Six Company, although they were a lot of people, basically all your friends. You all decided, we're going to make these recordings. We got this Fostex 4-track here, whatever. You know, kids, for those of you who don't know, before digital, you had to buy this cassette deck that enabled you to record 4 tracks. If you really had a fancy one, you could do 8.
It was the most magical device. Before I owned one, I spent my life savings and bought a Fostex 4-track when I was 15. But before that, I used to have dreams, like really, really, really strong dreams that I would like wander into a pawn shop and I'd find a 4-track for $5 or something that was affordable on my allowance. And like, you know, these were like wonderful dreams. I still have that dream. Sometimes, even now, and I'm about to turn 30, I'm turning 36 this week, like even now I'll go and like, I still have the dream sometimes that I walk into a pawn shop and I find this, you know, this 80s era Fostex 4-track for $5.
Well, when you love the kind of music that you guys loved, you know, Pink Floyd's Piper at the Gates of Dawn or the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds or the Beatles' Revolver, when you think that these were recorded in 4-track studios that in 67 or so were the state of the art, and now, you know, for a couple of $100, I can buy a cassette deck that would enable me to do that in my garage. Amazing.
I did not know. I honestly did not know that the Beatles had fancier equipment than a Fostex 4-track. I knew they used a 4-track. I envisioned them sitting in Abbey Road with a tiny little, you know, Fostex 4-track recording, yeah. And I assumed that I could do just as well as a producer, as George Martin. I started recording.
Yeah.
I bought the 4-track. I would record my friends. I recorded my own music. It was really up until I got an 8-track when we were doing the first Apples record, Fun Trick Noisemaker, that I realized that the Beatles had more than just 4-tracks. They also had, it was a quarter, you know, a 1-inch tape machine and you know, this gigantic studio full of tube compressors and stuff. And
And they could call the orchestra in, Robert, you know.
I can call the orchestra in too. It's just it was on my Casio keyboard.
Yeah, there you go. So what became everybody doing these 4-track tapes in the garage or the basement, right, or the studio?
They were often boombox. While we were in high school and stuff, a lot of our stuff was recorded. We had figured out how to multi-track with a boombox. It was probably my first musical accomplishment was that I had a boombox that had 2 cassettes in it. So you could like record on 1 cassette, then play it back and record on the other cassette while the music was coming out of the speakers.
And
you could multi-track that way. So that was how we started recording. And we made lots of great psychedelic recordings, you know, using boomboxes up until, you know, I think the last time I used a boombox to multi-track was when I was about 23. So like it was a method that I used well into, you know, us having started Elephant Six. You can get some good stuff.
Well, and that's where the name came from, right? Any tape that you guys made, you would mark as...
As Elephant Six. Actually, we decided that we needed to start a label. We had the sound. We had the sound, and we figured that there might be 10 to 40 people in the country that would be interested. So we decided that we were going to put out 7 inches and cassette tapes, and we were trying to get everybody on board, all of our friends and everybody that we might meet of those 40 people around the country that were obsessed with the Beach Boys. It turns out there were more than 40 people. But from my perspective, I was listening to my friends' music, and it was brilliant. My own music, I had great ambition about without making any quality judgment on it, you know? And so we decided that we were going to start a label, so to speak. I said to my friend Will, that's W. Cullen Hart, I said, Will, we're going to have a label, what are we going to call it? And he just off the top of his head, as soon as the words left my mouth, he said Elephant Six. Will is very psychedelic. He's a surrealist. He is a surrealist by like religious faith.
This is the man, you know, now William was one of the two key guys in Olivia Tremor Control. This is the only group in my mind in history that debuted with a triple album. A debut triple album. Yeah.
I think that's probably true.
Plus a bonus EP, right?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. They had quite a lot of music on there. I was very proud of that record.
Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, more of our conversation with Elephant Six's Robert Schneider. And later in the show, we'll review the new record by 4AD Pioneers, Dead Can Dance. Please tell the here and now, present the case somehow, and open up that.
What do you do?
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And that is a little bit of About Your Fame, a song by the Apples in Stereo, one of the three big bands in the Elephant Six recording collective. What was Elephant Six? It started out in the early 90s as a group of teenage friends from Ruston, Louisiana, who got together to listen to psychedelic pop records. They loved the Beach Boys and Pink Floyd. As they got older, they formed their own groups, and we're talking about some of the most beloved bands of the indie rock 90s, the Olivia Tremor Control, Neutral Milk Hotel, and the Apples in Stereo. The records they created, in particular, Greg, I think Neutral Milk Hotel's In the Airplane Over the Sea and the debut from the Olivia Tremor Control, Dusk at Cuba's Castle, hold up as masterpieces of psychedelic pop music from any era. Last month, we got the sad news that Bill Doss, a key member of the Olivia Tremor Control, co-founder of that group, had died unexpectedly. It got us thinking about the legacy of Elephant Six, and today we're revisiting our 2007 conversation with the founding member of the collective, Robert Schneider.
Robert's best known as a songwriter in Apples in Stereo, but he was really the impresario of that whole scene. You know, he recorded his friends, played in their bands, produced their records. He was the closest thing Elephant Six had to a record label head. But despite the name these guys gave themselves, I mean, they called themselves the Elephant Six Recording Company. I mean, Elephant Six never really functioned as a business. So in 2007, I asked Robert, was Elephant Six a label or an idea?
It was a record label in that we would put out our own music, and after about 6 months of us having Elephant Six, all of our bands got signed. And so we kept Elephant Six, but it went from being basically us selling cassettes and 7 inches out of our basement apartment into all having labels that wanted to put out our records. So we, at that point, Elephant Six became a kind of like a, it was like a society, you know, or something. And it was a society that was like by invitation only.
A society of outsiders. I think it's really important to notice this, Robert, because you're talking about the mid-90s here. And what you guys were doing, home recording on this very crude equipment, making these incredibly elaborate songs. You were packing every idea you ever had into these 3-minute songs, or you were creating these multi-part songs, these elaborate suites. And there was nothing else. I mean, think about what was going on at the time elsewhere in the commercial culture at the time. You had sort of like the, you know, the death throes of grunge. You know, Nirvana was fading out. The Smashing Pumpkins were huge. We were transitioning over into the Creed, Korn era. Hip-hop was hitting its most commercial phase, and you guys were doing this kind of very elaborate music on a shoestring budget in the middle of nowhere, and you were getting signed to record deals. I mean, how did that happen?
If we could have taken down every single one of those bands you mentioned and never have heard another note from them, destroyed their guitars, and made sure that they would never play another note, we would have. But all we could do was pull out our 4-tracks and try to make some really great psychedelic pop music. That, you know, we just wanted to make something that meant something. We wanted you to go buy this record and have it practically like explode into your lap full of like posters and stickers and these great songs and all of this stuff. You know, we like imagine that like, you know, when you buy a record, it would be like you'd open it up into like this tropical garden, you know. And like when we started Elephant Six, we were at war. We put out a mission statement that was basically, you know, saying what we believed in, and we were trying to, I mean, we were at war with everything. We were at war with punk rock, we were at war with, you know, the top 40, we were at war with the past. We were like, you know, we were like, it was a very loving war. It's the kind of war where you want to convert everybody to your side, you know, not like just get rid of them. You know, if I could have made Smashing
war.
I mean, and in fact, I was going to say, if I could have made Smashing Pumpkins turn into a pop band, but maybe we did, you know. So like, it's like, you know, it was a war that, like, you know, it's a little bit at a time, and yeah, it was a love war, like you said.
You're listening to a little bit of Marking Time from the Olivia Tremor Control. They're a fantastic, mind-blowing debut album. Double CD, by the way, Jim, Dusk at Cuba's Castle. The Olivias were the trippiest, I think, of the big three out of Ruston, Louisiana. I think Schneider was sort of the pop craftsman, the tunesmith, the guy who loved that pristine studio sound. And you had Jeff Mangum, who we're going to be talking about in a minute here, the Neutral Milk Hotel founder, who was kind of the soul child, the wild card, the guy who loved mistakes and turned accidents into great recordings. And then you had the Olivias, who were just pure out and out. trippy psychedelia. They were the ones who looked under the rock. Wow, there's a world underneath that rock. Let me write an entire album about that.
Well, the subtitle of that debut album, Dusk at Cuba's Castle, is Music from an Unrealized Film Script. I think Robert touched on this briefly, but, you know, it wasn't enough to just make a debut double album. We had to have had soundtrack music that was crafted for this film that doesn't really exist, that never got made, and that nobody even described. But look, They Wanted to Take You is the classic psychedelic goal. We want to create a world that exists only in the space between your headphones. We're going to take you there. We're going to transport you. A lot of it was about the studio. But, Greg, I don't know how many of these bands you got to see live, because what you basically had was a bunch of hippies, but they were indie rock, punk rock kind of kids. So they would think nothing of piling 13, 14 people in a van.
Right.
Okay, and driving for hours and hours and hours. In 96 or 97, I went to a festival out in Rhode Island called the Ptolemaic Terrascope. It was called Terrastock. And I remember the Olivias pulling up, and it was like one of those cartoon clown cars where kids just kept coming out of this van, and they're carrying flugelhorns, and they're carrying, you know, timpani, and there's like 16 or 19 people on stage.
I know.
And I didn't even realize it at the time, but it was basically, you know, Schneider is there, and the Apples are there, and, you know, there's Mangum, he's playing a snare drum, and they would all play with each other all the time. And as they spread out from Ruston across the country, you know, some of them are living in Brooklyn, some of them are living in Athens, Georgia, and Schneider and Hillary Sidney, the drummer in Apples, who was his wife at the time, they go up to Denver. They would all stay on each other's floors. And basically, whenever the Apples came to any city, it was guaranteed they had about seven or eight friends who lived there who'd wind up on stage.
Yeah.
And they were traveling with seven or eight people. And so it was always this wild kind of thing. They were as good live as they were on record.
It was a romper room kind of vibe. I did see all these bands live at the time, and you'd have guys on stage and gals who would be playing six or seven instruments during the course of a single song sometimes.
Yes.
Just switching off instruments, picking up an instrument, adding another layer to the song. The Olivia Tremor Control tried to capture some of that vibe on their records. They made the densest records of anyone else on Elephant Six. On these little tape recorders, they would just multi-track and multi-track and multi-track and bounce it down and multi-track some more, so that you'd have these threads of sound, these seas, rivers of sound running through the recordings. You'd have backward tape loops. You'd have a horn. You'd have a guitar. You'd have a bass piled on top of that. You'd have some timpani going on.
Yeah.
You'd have a tambourine playing off in the left-hand channel.
We're coming to the surface and into the distance, constantly showering me with decision.
Layering all these instruments and creating these trippy, mind-expanding records that at the same time preserve the integrity of the song. I mean, they loved melodies. So we talk about that magical combination, melody and noise. Olivia Tremor Control were masters when it came to achieving that balance.
When you were young, you were the king of cauliflowers, and how you built the tower tumbling through the trees in holy rattlesnakes that fell.
That is King of Carrot Flowers, Part 1, from what is widely considered the masterpiece from the Elephant Six stable of bands, Neutral Milk Hotels in the Airplane Over the Sea, from 1998. You can see why that album, I think, has a certain long-lasting appeal. Of all the Elephant Six guys, Mangum went for that stripped-down, more of a stripped-down sound. I'm not going to say it was naked, but he certainly was about soul, about,
yeah.
I am sitting down here, I'm pouring my guts out, and I'm singing, you know, these songs about Anne Frank from the 1940s, and they mean something to me today. And he would argue with Schneider about this stuff. You know, Schneider wanted a more pristine, more beautiful sound, and Mangum goes, I want those mistakes in there.
Well, yeah, but we are still talking about an album that has flugelhorn all over it.
Sure.
And Mangum was playing the singing saw and doing all this psychedelic stuff. But you're right, Greg. What, in his case, was the key was the vocal and the acoustic guitar. And all this other stuff decorated it. I think because he was singing straight from the gut, he related to people in a very deep and lasting way that I've only ever seen in my lifetime with Kurt Cobain. And it's interesting. You and I have both had this experience. We've talked about it, where we go to talk to college classes, and kids who are asking about our job will come up to us afterwards said, you know, you interviewed Kurt Cobain, with this like tone of hushed reverence. I once had a girl want to shake my hand because I had once shaken Kurt Cobain's hand. And it's insane. The only other artist I ever get that with from a younger generation is Jeff Mangum. I mean, you interviewed Jeff Mangum? Mm-hmm. And there is this cult that surrounds him. And I think it's just because he touched people very, very, very deeply. We talked to Robert Schneider about why and some of the reasons why and how this record was made.
He is a really great songwriter, and he's a very soulful person, and a very, he's a very endearing person, and he deserves to be held in at least as high esteem as Kurt Cobain.
Did you have a sense when you were making In the Airplane Over the Sea that this was a special record?
Oh yeah, I mean, when Jeff came to Denver to make that record, he wanted to do something really special, and I promised him, I knew that he would leave the studio with the perfect record, exactly what he wanted. He has a very peculiar vision, and I'm his best friend. My vision took backseat. I wanted to make him happy, and I wanted him to have something that he would be proud of, and that was, you know, true to his kind of, you know, his inner feelings and stuff. Yeah, I mean, it was a very special time. We had millions of friends coming through town. And anyway, outside of just recording the album, it was a special time in our lives. We were starting to make records. We were starting to tour. We were being very creative. Elephant Six, you know, we were trading music all the time and constantly challenging each other. It wasn't just that album. It was the time, you know, it was that time of kind of youthful explosion. And it was a wonderful time. And it, you know, still we feel that. Mm-hmm. But at the time, we were all together, living together in the same closet or whatever, you know, like there were, you know, I'd have 75 people sleeping in my studio or whatever. You know, it was a fun time, like the way that, say, like college is a fun time, except for that we all dropped out of college, you know.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
Like it was, you know, and like I knew we were making a special record at that time. Every record that we made was magic, and I still listen to them and I hear magic. And there was no effort. The effort was making it good enough, making it great, you know. Like we would every day go to the studio and I would be like, Jeff, I'd wake him up in the morning and be like, we're making a classic album. Do you know that your record is a classic album? And he'd be like, you mean it, Robert? You think so? And I'd be like, dude, you know, just let's go get back to work on it. And he'd jump out of bed and, you know, we kind of wandered to the studio. And like, you know, it was a very special time. And, you know, it was kind of like summer camp extended over our 20s.
What a beautiful face I have found in this place that is circling all around the sun. What a beautiful dream that could flash on the screen in a blink of an eye and be gone from me. Soft and sweet, let me hold it close and keep it here with me.
What about the mythologizing of Jeff in recent years since this record came out? You know, this is one of those rock and roll founding myths. An artist makes an incredible record, connects with people, but he has some kind of a disconnect with reality, disappears from the scene. This is Syd Barrett, this is Rocky Erickson, this is Brian Wilson in The Sandbox. To an extent, it's become the Jeff Mangum story. We haven't heard music from him on record since In the Airplane Over the Sea.
Okay, well, I'll say for one thing, he never fell out of touch with reality. He's more in touch with reality now than ever and with, you know, than most people. That's all I'm going to say. I don't want to touch the mythology because I'm not that close to it. He's my friend. I see him all the time. I'm not going to say anything else, actually, because I want to leave that as an open topic.
I don't know what to say. What people are saying, he made this masterpiece, what a lot of people consider one of the great records of the 90s. And that's it. Never heard from him again in terms of a musical kind of follow-up. It's kind of like the My Bloody Valentine thing. You make this amazing record that everybody talks about, and where's the follow-up?
One thing is that, you know, in the case of Syd Barrett and Brian Wilson, these are people who have basically nervous breakdowns. And Jeff, you know, Jeff has not had a nervous breakdown. He's somebody who is passionately on a quest of self-discovery and of kind of understanding of the universe. And I understand because I'm like that too. In fact, all of my friends from Ruston are like that, and many of my friends. You know, it's sort of a common theme in our social circle to be on a quest of discovery. But he's on a quest of self-discovery, and making music was sort of the first steps of that. I can't say that he's moved beyond that or that that's going to be on the path again. He wasn't trying to be a rock star. He wasn't trying to make a living. He was trying to find out about himself and about the universe. And he's a very sweet, a gentle, and extremely creative person. And, you know, he's somebody whose thoughts, one would think the content of his thoughts are similar to the content of most of our dreams.
Yeah.
I don't see him as this mythological character. I see him as an extremely sweet friend of mine that I love. And he's very talented. And he's an artist and he's a writer. And he does all sorts of talented things that he's always done, and music was always just one of them.
Robert, thank you so much. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on your show.
That's the track Sundial Song from the Apples in Stereo, Robert Schneider's band, and an integral part of the Elephant Six Collective. When we originally aired that interview with Robert back in 2007, we ended our discussion of the big three Elephant Six bands by talking about the Apples in Stereo. That track we just played was from the then-new Apples in Stereo record, New Magnetic Wonder, which we both reviewed on the show and we both loved. It was, you know, in a lot of ways a return to power pop form for the band. Over the course of their recordings since 1995, they've tried a lot of different things. Fun Trick Noisemaker was really this weird, very Pink Floyd, Sid Barrett era noise rock record. In fact, Apples in Stereo, Robert has said, was inspired by the Pink Floyd song Apples and Oranges. Tone Soul Evolution put a little bit of soul in the mix. Her Wallpaper Reverie is, dare I say it, a very Brian Eno type of ambient record. They've been all over the map, and they've released one other really strong record since New Magnetic Wonder, Travelers in Space and Time, in 2010. Robert, as I said, I think was the big motivational engine for the whole Elephant Six group. He recorded all of his friends' bands. He played on their records, Olivier Tremor Control's albums and Jeff Mangum, Neutral Milk Hotel's albums. He just kept things going. But I think it's easy because of that to slight what the Apples did. They are a very exciting psychedelic pop band that has always made wonderful music, and I think in a way that the other two groups could be a little shambolic and disorganized live, the Apples by far were always the best rock band on stage in concert. In the last couple of years, Bill Doss of the Olivia Tremor Control have been playing in Apples in Stereo, so it is a loss to everyone in that group because they were such friends, but because they also played on each other's recordings to such an extent. You know, at the time we wrapped up that talk with Robert, he was talking about how everybody was still making music even if they weren't doing so in public, except for the Apples in Stereo. It would come to pass that the Olivia Tremor Control would slowly but surely reunite. They played the Pitchfork Music Festival this year. They were recording some new music. Single has come out of that. We don't know how much else is going to come out of that before Bill Doss's untimely death derailed the group. But the biggest news of all was the return of Neutral Milk Hotel. Nobody ever thought that this reclusive, wonderful musician, Jeff Mangum, would get on stage again and play the songs from those two albums that Neutral Milk Hotel released in their lifetime. You and I were both at those concerts. They were great. There was no new music, though.
That's true, Jim. But when we talk about this legacy, what stands out to me is how hungry people were to hear this music again. I mean, you and I were at a lot of those shows that they played in the 90s when they came to the Midwest and Chicago specifically.
And nobody really cared.
And there was a few hundred people there if they were lucky. And now that audience has quintupled. People were moved by these songs in a way that I don't think would have been possible to imagine in 97, 98.
No.
Now it has reached a point where you can see the legacy of what those Elephant Six bands meant, that music that they created, and how it has held up over time. So in a way, Doss's death is really tragic because I think people, more than ever, were ready to hear some new music from these guys, and his death deprives us maybe of some new Olivia Control music. But I think a lot of fans, after seeing Mangum this year, are saying, man, that next Neutral Milk Hotel record, it could be huge if he just came back with something. We'll never know. But the legacy certainly has held up well over time.
2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
What are your thoughts on Elephant Six? Let us know by calling our hotline, 888-859-1800. Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, Greg and I review the new album from Dead Can Dance, and I drop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that is Dead Can Dance with their first album in a very long time, Anastasis, and a track called Children of the Sun. That is Brendan Perry, the guitarist and songwriter in the band, along with vocalist Lisa Gerard. They started out 30 years ago in Australia, unique sounding band in the 80s, one of the first signings to the venerated 4AD label. They combined the music of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance with ambient pop music, some new age, some world music. Nobody sounded quite like Dead Can Dance. Now, they continued making music through 1997 when the couple split apart, reunited for a tour in 2005, very well received, but no new album. The prospects were that they would never record again. They had both gone on to solo careers, notably Gerard making a number of film soundtracks, including one for The Gladiator. So there was really no driving need for the two of them to get back together again. But then, in the midst of those Australian brush fires, Gerard had moved back to Australia. Her property caught on fire, and Perry, who is now living in Ireland, gave her a call and said, "How you doing? Is everything okay?" And from that conversation a few years ago, they said, "Hey, let's give it a go. Let's bring Dead Can Dance back together again." So now, their first album since 1997, 16 years ago, we have Anastasis from Dead Can Dance. Here's a track from it. It's called Agape on Sound Opinions.
Thank you.
That was Agape from Dead Can Dance from their first album in 16 years, Anastasis. Agape, Greg, the Greek word for an all-encompassing universal love. I am sorry to say I have no universal love for Dead Can Dance. Look, the dead might be able to dance, but they don't dance nearly enough on this record as far as I'm concerned. I cannot believe you chose to bump in with the track Children of the Sun, which beyond the lyrics, which are some of the most laughable I think we've ever played on Sound Opinions, there is just that plodding, arrhythmic. It's dead, man. Dead is the only word for it. Lisa Gerrard has a beautiful voice, and I have a reputation in Sound Opinions parts for being the big goth fan here, deserved or otherwise, but I just have never gotten into Dead Can Dance. I don't like the rhythms. I don't like the approach. You know, there's goth. There's goth that's moody and kind of tongue-in-cheek, and then there's goth that takes itself way too seriously. You know, Lisa Gerrard wrote the soundtrack for Gladiator, and it all always sounds like that Gladiator melodramatic music to me. On the buy it, burn it, trash it scale, I'm sorry, Dead Can Dance. This is a trash it record.
Well, I gotta say, in the 80s, I loved Dead Can Dance because nobody else sounded like it. They introduced me to a lot of music that I didn't really know a lot about. I mean, you know, going back to the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, pulling some melodies out of there, ambient pop music, world music. To my mind, they were the one band from that era that could unite fans of Gregorian chants and Nick Cave. I mean, there was a common ground. That was the group.
Well, I don't know if that's a good thing.
Now, but this comeback really strikes me as almost like it was brokered by lawyers. You know, you've got the Brendan Perry songs, and then you've got the Lisa Gerrard songs. And the Perry song, I play that for a reason. I mean, this sort of stately, you know, intonation that he gives it, like he's reading the stone tablets. It really is annoying, and the words aren't very good. So Perry seems to have either phoned it in or taking himself much too seriously, whereas Gerrard, when she does those wordless vocals, it's still incredibly entrancing, incredibly beautiful. In comparison to the masterworks from this group, like The Serpent's Egg from 88 or Aeon from 1990, this is definitely second-rate Dead Can Dance. But for the Gerrard tracks alone, I think fans are going to want to hear that voice again after 16 years. I'll give it a burn it rating.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
You remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Stranded, I'm so far from home. Stranded, yeah, I'm on my own. Stranded, you gotta leave me alone, cause I'm stranded on my own.
I have rented a plane. I am dropping by parachute into the desert island to hear what Jim DeRogatis has got to play for the Desert Island Jukebox pick this week. Jim?
Wow, that's very ambitious. I'm just like the Queen at the Olympics a couple of weeks ago. Greg, the progressive rock band Genesis has been on my mind a lot lately. There's a book being put together by a good buddy of ours, Mark Weingarten, asking a bunch of writers to reassess the often maligned legacy of progressive rock. He asked me to tackle Genesis, and I volunteered wholeheartedly. Now, there really were three versions of Genesis. You know, the Phil Collins version of the group from the last 15 years, probably the most famous, all those pop hits like I Can't Dance. There's a middle period progressive rock band after Peter Gabriel left the group and Phil Collins took over his vocals. That's okay, and I've played them before as a Desert Island Jukebox pick. But man, that early Genesis, the second album through the fifth, the period where Peter Gabriel was the singer, Phil Collins was still on drums, Mike Rutherford and Tony Banks, the guys who really put the band together, were there on bass and keyboards, and you had Steve Hackett join the group as an incredibly inventive guitarist whose guitar never sounded like a guitar. That was an incredible band. The first of these records with this new lineup that really crystallized what Genesis was Nursery Crime in 1971. Now, granted, I fell in love with this music when I was a very impressionable 15, 16-year-old teenager, okay? They fit incredibly well into a world of Renaissance fairs and Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov and Dungeons and Dragons, what you would call kind of the proto-goth, proto-steampunk of the era. It was a fun comic book trip. Now, it is impossible to get Gabriel, Collins, Banks, or Rutherford to talk about these songs. And this one is one of the silliest I'm going to play. This is a short story in the space of a song. It's called The Return of the Giant Hogweeds. A Victorian-era explorer goes over to Russia and comes back with this plant that they plant at the Royal Gardens, the Kew Gardens. It begins to take on a life of its own, and it's strangling all of the British Empire. Poor Queen Victoria is losing her mind. These killer plants are taking over the empire. It was a wonderful band. It's Genesis, The Return of the Giant Hogweed on Sound Opinions.
Turn and run. Nothing can stop them. All around every river and canal, their power is growing. Stamp them out. We must destroy them. They infiltrate each city with their thick, dark warning odor. They are invincible. They see the
That was Genesis from 1971 with The Return of the Giant Hogweed. The Sound Opinions Desert Island Jukebox is supported by Maker's Mark. Maker's Mark Bourbon, it is what it isn't. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have an in-studio visit by the anti-Genesis, the punk band Off.
Greg, as always, Sound Opinions has some thank yous to say on the way out. The show is produced by Jason Saldana and Robin Lynn. Our assistant producers are Andy Minoff and Michael DeBonis. And our executive producer, our fearless leader, Tori Southside Malatia. You ain't lived until you've seen him do that Genesis I Can't Dance dance.
And if you won't.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hey guys, my name is Wes from Philadelphia. I was calling to talk about your UK 77 punk show. I thought it was great, but I think you missed one important band, Crass. Say that one song, Punk is Dead.
Yes, that's right. My case, that is just another trait for our fellow countrymen say. Metal drop, rock, your plastic chances. Your boss and issue, but I'm in turn of matters. Yes, bro, I'm out of the clash. I'm a revolution, it's just some cash. I've become a fashion like it used to be. I can't think of doing it for me.
And also, in terms of influence, you know, there's a whole water, crust, punk, train hopper thing going on strong still today. And I think they set the template for that. Anyway, I love the show. I'm going to listen to it next week, too. So keep it up. Bye.
Hey, this is Mark from Denver, and I just wanted to say, fantastic show on the 1977 New York retrospective, but just have to call and defend the shirts a little bit. There was one little quick comment that suggested that they were more after fame and glory than some of their counterparts, and I actually happened to get to know the shirts, and they were just tremendous people and down to earth, including Annie Golden.
Back up here, and I'm shaking skulls.
fantastic band, underrated, and not stargazers, in my opinion. Thanks a lot, and great show. Bye.
Hi, Sound Opinions. This is Andy calling from Mariposa, California, and I just wanted to thank you for that great review of the new Antibalas record. I couldn't agree more. They do, as you said, put on a spectacular live show. And I just wanted to share one of my favorite stories of seeing them or anyone else. I was living in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 2004, and I saw them at the Black Cat in downtown Washington, D.C. And I've always wondered what would happen at a show if the crowd just didn't leave. And it happened at that show. The crowd just stood there, and they stomped their feet and cheered, and we all clapped, and about 10 minutes later, they said, okay, we'll play another song. And just what an electrifying evening. Those guys really know how to turn it up. And if anyone out there has not seen them, they should, because it rules. But thank you so much again for the review. Keep up the good work.
Hey, guys, it's Don from Kenosha, Wisconsin. I was just listening to your show on songs for each day of the week, and wow, awesome job, guys. And thank you so much for Thursday. Morphine? All right, man, that was excellent.
We used to meet every Thursday in the afternoon.
And I was also thinking about another song for Monday. I Don't Like Mondays by the Boomtown Rat.
Tell me why.
Anyway, guys, thank you so much for a great show. Take it easy now.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.